It is a sunny 75 degree day here in Washington, D.C. There is joy in the crowd. There's excitement in the crowd.
Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. You're listening to the voice of Dorian Warren. Of course, as you know, Dorian is co-host of The Takeaway Deep Dives. And in his day job, he's co-president of Community Change and co-chair of the Economic Security Project. And Dorian was wearing all of these hats back in mid-June in downtown Washington, D.C.
There's actually a sense that people have been waiting for this moment because it's been too long, the last 2 years in the pandemic, for people to come together to lift their voices around these issues, the issues of poverty and racism, climate change, but with a moral view. This isn't like a policy event.
Dorian and a couple of intrepid producers from Team Takeaway were present as thousands of people came together for a mass demonstration and march along Pennsylvania Avenue. The action was called by the Poor People's Campaign, which describes its work as a national call for moral revival. And before the event took place, I spoke with Bishop William Barber, national co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign. He explained why morality is the organizing principle of their work.
And we're saying that is immoral, it's morally indefensible, it's constitutionally inconsistent, it's politically insensitive, and it's economically insane not to address this issue of poverty and low wealth, and it's damaging to the very soul and the possibility of this country. That's why this gathering is not about people coming and laughing and having a fellowship. We're really calling the nation to repentance by forcing people to hear, see the faces of poor and low wealth people and to hear the tears and the demands that they have.
In 2020, under the excruciating weight of the pandemic, poverty rates and numbers rose for the first time in 5 years. There were 3.3 million more people living in poverty in 2020 than there were a year earlier. Poverty rose among white and Hispanic Americans, among children and adults, and even among married couples. All were poorer in 2020 than the year before. For the 1 in 5 Black Americans living in poverty, there wasn't even any room for the rate to go higher. But luckily, a package of pandemic-era policies stemmed the rising tide of poverty in 2021. But many of those temporary measures have expired, even as consumer prices continue to rise. All of which makes this the right moment for a deep dive into America's movement to end poverty.
For me, your freedom is...
We must meet in the streets. We must meet at the ballot box. We must meet at the political suites of this nation. We have to cry loud from the pulpits and the public square.
From where we are standing, I only see literally a sea of people with signs in a range of movement shirts who have all shown up today to basically tell the political elites in this town in Washington, D.C., we are here, you work for us, and you need to do your jobs.
Hey, Dorian, it is so good to have you, and thanks for reporting from the march. It sounds like you had some powerful experiences there.
Thanks, Melissa. So glad to be here. And yes, the team and I talked to a lot of people during the march.
And listen, I feel like it's important for folks to know that the movement to end poverty, that's the water you swim in every day.
That is the case. I think one of the core themes of my work, and this is my work across multiple sectors and multiple fields, has really been a focus on poverty. And the fact that poverty is not an ordained or natural system or condition, but really a system of policy choices. And I've always had a deep curiosity about poverty, whether as an academic, an organizer, a journalist. And even though we have inherited the relative luxuries of higher education and good wages and home ownership, we are both just one generation away from severe poverty. Now, my grandmother used to say that she didn't grow up poor, she grew up po, because she couldn't afford the OR.
So I think the question about who is poor and why people are poor is really important. You know, we live in the United States, the richest country in the history of the world, and we have 140 million people who are poor or one healthcare crisis, one job loss, one storm, one tornado away from economic ruin.
This is the Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris. Along with Bishop Barber, she's a national co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, and she helped us get a sense of poverty in this country.
One of the first misconceptions about who is poor is that people are poor because they're lazy or they don't want to work or they're having too many kids, right? But we have 52 million people who work every day in this country who do not make a living wage. More than half of those that are unhoused in our society work. I mean, there's not a county, there's not a city, there's not a town anywhere in these United States where if you're working full-time at the federal minimum wage, that you can afford to even rent a two-bedroom apartment.
Wait, what?
There's not a town anywhere in these United States at the federal minimum wage that you can afford to even rent a two-bedroom apartment.
Come on. Nowhere?
Nowhere. Let me show you, Melissa. Okay, go to your search engine and find the National Low Income Housing Coalition report titled Out of Reach.
All right, I got it. Ooh, this has got an interactive map. I love this. Okay, I'm clicking on Arkansas because I know the cost of living in Arkansas is low.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what does it tell you?
Yo, Dorian, this is bananas. Minimum wage in Arkansas is $11 an hour. And apparently, at this current minimum wage, you'd have to work 53 hours a week to afford a two-bedroom apartment and 43 hours to afford even a single bedroom.
Yeah, so Melissa, you probably should not click on your home state of North Carolina.
No.
Yep. You'd have to work 102 hours a week at a minimum wage gig to afford a two-bedroom apartment.
I can't even.
Yeah, right? And understanding this reality, that there is really nowhere, Melissa, nowhere you can live while working full-time for minimum wage, this reality helps us understand just how pervasive poverty and economic vulnerability really, really is. Here's Reverend Liz Theo Harris again.
The reality about poverty in this society is that, again, we live in a country that has almost half of its people that are living in poverty or so close to poverty that they can't afford an emergency. So people come in and out of that reality. You know, folks are very vulnerable and can fall into poverty, can lose that health insurance, can lose that job, can lose their housing, you know, really at any moment. And so one of the things that we're talking about by raising up this 140 million people who are poor and low income is that this is not some small section of society, one grouping of people that live one place in the country, but this is an economic condition of life here in the United States.
I keep thinking back to this conversation, Dorian, that you and I had nearly 2 years ago now with Aisha Yanduro, the CEO of Springboard to Opportunities. That's the organization that offers no strings attached cash assistance to poor Black mothers living in Mississippi. And during our conversation, Aisha asked us a simple question.
Mm-hmm. How much does a gallon of milk cost?
No one ever knows how much milk costs. I know if my child needs milk, I go buy the milk, period. The women that I work with can tell you how much milk costs at three different stores.
Realizing I did not readily know the price of milk illustrated just how much economic privilege I have.
I hear you on this because I know both of our grandmas knew the price of milk, right? And by the way, right now, the national average for a gallon of whole milk is $4.33. But this gallon of milk question is a good reminder of how poverty is defined. So listen, the federal government determines the national poverty line or threshold. Currently, for a family of four, that poverty line is $26,500 a year. That's $6,625 per person. And so for an entire year of food, a an entire year of housing and, of course, expenses. That's $18 a day.
Okay, but where did that number come from?
Well, it's a 55-year-old formula developed by a civil servant, the late Molly Orshansky. Now, Orshansky grew up in poverty, and when she started working for the Social Security Administration in the 1940s, she discovered there was no standard definition that allowed the government to define and track the severity of poverty. She developed a formula identifying how much it should cost to feed a family of four based on average food prices of standard items. Then she took that and multiplied that number by three. But using a standardized grocery budget to determine poverty is, problematic to say the least. So 5 decades ago, food was a much bigger part of a household budget. In 1955, when Orshansky was developing this measure, food was roughly one-third of a family's budget. And even with inflation, today, food is on average about 10% of Americans' personal budgets, whereas the cost of housing, of healthcare, of childcare, of transportation are all much more consequential than milk. And it means that the experience of poverty is even more widespread than the official definition tells us.
The poverty line, as it is currently measured, is wholly inadequate. Anytime we have policies that are connected to the federal poverty line, they are not looking at the full depth and breadth of who is poor in our society. It's those that are near poverty that are in need of social programs and uplift as well.
Want to know what this really looks like?
Yes.
Okay, back to your search engine, Melissa. And this time, head on over to confrontingpoverty.org.
Ooh, wow. Okay, so this is a poverty risk calculator?
Exactly. So this simulator was developed by Professor Mark Rank at Washington University in St. Louis. And just by inputting five characteristics, age, race, gender, education, and marital status, it can tell you just how likely it is that you will experience at least 1 year of poverty.
All right, so let me put this in. Okay, let's try unmarried, woman of color, late 30s, who didn't go to college.
A 67.9% risk of poverty in the next 10 years.
Okay, let's try a different one here. Married, white man, early 40s, some education beyond high school.
A 7.8% risk of poverty in the next 10 years.
Okay, I'm starting to get it. The movement to end poverty has some really core challenges here. I mean, to start, we have a definition of poverty that is outdated and inadequate for identifying the real scope of the experience. And with just a few clicks, it becomes pretty clear that some folks are particularly vulnerable and that vulnerability is attached to some other, let's call them, politically salient identities.
When you look at the 140 million people who are poor and low income, we know that more than half of those folk are women and girls identified. So about 74 million people. And when we look at, for instance, who are working low-wage jobs, you know, about two-thirds of low-wage workers are women, especially women of color, Black, Latino, Indigenous, Asian women. So the history of patriarchy, of sexism, play a huge role in the fact that we have so many people who are, and so many women and women-identified people, poor and low-income. Same when we look at sexual orientation and sexuality. You know, the greatest number of unhoused youth are folks that are queer and trans and LGBTQ. When we look at gender, when we look at sexual orientation, when we look at gender expression, all of this comes to play in who is poor and why people are poor. And yet, it is also the case that people across gender, across sexuality, are experiencing poverty in this, the richest country in the world.
And let me add one more layer. Because of the ways that we connect poverty to other stigmatized identities, many of us refuse to think about ourselves as poor. Research shows that Americans overwhelmingly identify themselves as middle class, even when they're not. And this is why Reverend Theo Harris says that developing a sense of shared identity is part of what the Poor People's Campaign is working to do.
And yet there has been for decades now a stigma on people calling themselves poor and on people referring to others as poor and impoverished. What I think we're seeing all across the country in these waves of low-wage workers organizing, whether it's with the Fight for 15 or organizers and workers at Starbucks or Amazon, whether it's folks that are calling for the human right to health care right now in this public health crisis, whether it's folks that are unhoused and living on the streets and with family. I mean, I think we see more and more people, you know, putting out there that they're just not making it, that they're poor, that folks are low income. How can it be that millionaires and billionaires have made trillions of dollars in the course of a pandemic and millions more families have been thrown and shoved below the poverty line?
And the work is not easy, but there was tangible energy in the crowd at last weekend's Poor People's March.
Well, on Saturday, June 18th, we had thousands upon thousands. I mean, the crowd went back farther than my eyes could see. A diverse grouping of poor and impacted folks and folks from different movements and organizations. I mean, what I see is a fusion movement of people who identify as struggling in this society, who are saying it doesn't have to be this way. This is not our fault. This is not our doing. That society has failed poor and low-income people, and that we, the rejected, the marginalized, the disenfranchised, the dispossessed, are coming together, organizing together, and trying to call into this nation's consciousness that people have been hurting our people for far too long. We're not going to be silent anymore. We're not going to be unheard anymore. We're not going to be unseen anymore. And that we're going to keep on organizing and building the kind of power to get the kind of policy and structural change that is necessary for our very survival.
I am Nikki Taylor. I'm from Memphis, Tennessee, and I'm part of the Memphis 7.
Back in January, Nikki was working as a barista at a Starbucks store near the University of Memphis. And as the Martin Luther King Day holiday approached, Nikki and six of her coworkers announced their plans to form a union. Now, their timing paid homage to the legacy of Dr. King, who was assassinated in Memphis in 1968 while helping the city's sanitation workers, who were locked in a public battle with the city as they tried to unionize. In a 2018 C-SPAN special, historian Ryan Jones described the conditions of Black Memphis sanitation workers.
Sanitation workers that were African-American only made about $1 an hour. You could be fired for being late to work for after 1 minute. You had no pension. You were given no other grievances during this period. You were not able to be a driver on a truck. You were only able to ride in the back of the cab.
According to the Washington Post, which reported the story back in February, Starbucks said these seven employees had committed significant violations of safety and security policies by remaining in the store after closing for an interview with local media. The company claimed it was those lapses, not the fact that they were trying to organize, that led to their firings. In a statement, company spokesperson Reggie Borges told the Post, quote, "These egregious actions and blatant violations cannot be ignored." But firing workers for union activity is illegal, and the National Labor Relations Board is currently investigating more than 200 violations by Starbucks of labor law, including the case of the Memphis 7. But let's just say that was not the end of the story for the Memphis 7.
We have fought against their union busting to come in and fire me and six of my comrades. The store that they thought was going to lose, baby, we got that union. We won.
That's Nikki Taylor speaking at the Poor People's March in D.C. And as you can tell, she's still excited because last month, that Memphis store that fired her in February, well, it voted 11-3 in favor of unionization. It's one of the more than 150 Starbucks stores across the country where employees have voted to join a union. I caught up with Nikki in D.C. at the march.
Okay, so we're here definitely representing Starbucks Workers United, but we're also here representing the working class period. We're here to fight for better rights, for better pay, to be able to have a voice in your workplace. We are from a right-to-work state, which is a very double-edged sword.
Now, just for a little context here, there are 27 states that have right-to-work laws, meaning that unions can operate legally, but workers cannot be required to join a union as a condition of employment. Conservative lawmakers describe these laws as protecting workers, while many workers' rights advocates say these rules just make it harder for workers to organize and tip the balance in favor of employers.
That means they can fire you for anything, and it's just not fair to people who have to have that job, to take care of their children, to take care of their bills and things like that. So, like I said, we're here fighting for Starbucks workers and Starbucks partners, but we're also here fighting for the working class.
And she wasn't alone. Starbucks workers from across the country were there to show support.
So we're all in this fight together, and we're here to express our solidarity with the working class across the country and show them that we're fighting to change that diligently, especially in the South. My name is Maggie Carter. I'm from Knoxville, Tennessee, the first store in the South to unionize. So we are just so grateful to be here supporting the Memphis 7 and supporting working class across America.
And I'm Layla Dalton. I'm actually from Phoenix, Arizona, and it's also a right-to-work state, so we also have kind of similar difficulties, and I'm just here to support, you know, the working class, support anyone that is scared to unionize and speak up because they don't know if they're going to get fired.
And this is about more than just Starbucks. In the last year, corporate giants from Amazon to Trader Joe's to Apple just last week have seen workers marshal successful attempts to unionize. But this day was about more than even union organizing. The people who came on Saturday were there to address the many interlocking issues of poverty, of inequality, and unfairness.
Hey, I'm Paula Becker. I'm a 79-year-old grandmother. I'm a retired nurse. I'm here today because we don't take good care of our people, our biggest resource.
My name is Lilith Clacken. I'm a home health aide in New York City, and I'm here to support whatever it takes for workers to be fully compensated so that we can properly take care of our families.
Kim Smith. And I'm here because it's immoral what this country does to poor people.
Well, I really believe in the message of the Poor People's Campaign. I think that it's so powerful to unite people behind one common cause that affects us all, that undoes structures of institutionalized racism and sexism and homophobia. And you feel the spirit here. It's infectious and it's beautiful, and I wouldn't want to be anywhere else today. My name is Zora Ruin, and I'm here with the Minnesota Poor People's Campaign.
In addition to these voices of workers and people who came from around the country to the march, even folks from the highest ranks of the labor movement showed up as well. Here's Fred Redmond, the newly elected Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO.
Well, I'm here today because this is where the labor movement's supposed to be. Our commitment is towards social and racial justice, and this movement is about, you know, lifting up those who's been disrespected, disinherited, despised. This is about low-wage workers, and this is where the labor movement's supposed to be.
So often in the town where I now live, Washington, D.C., I hear pundits and political consultants and even elected officials in daily conversations maligning ordinary Americans for being impatient or for believing that complicated issues are simple or for being so tied to identity politics they're unable to form broader coalitions. But as we talked with people throughout the day on Saturday, it was clear that these so-called ordinary Americans had complicated analyses and nuanced proposals to address the multiple interlocking causes of poverty and injustice. This was an entirely different conversation from the common ones I hear in this town. We talked to Ronald Blunt from the Philadelphia Unemployment Project, who provides direct assistance to people who have fallen through the cracks of an unemployment system that feels almost deliberate in its mistreatment of people trying to get help.
I live in New Jersey, but I work in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And what they did was anyone that lived out of the state, they just automatically threw them off. So what do? You call the phone, you get a constant busy signal. You send an email, you won't get an email back in like three to six months. And how are folks supposed to live during that period? You know, mm-hmm. We have people that's been waiting over a year for their benefits. So we've been going to Harrisburg. We take van loads of folks out there. And they talk to their legislators or any legislator that'll listen. And a lot of times, not only do they get their own private problem fixed, but anyone that has similar problems, they also get those problems fixed as well. And what really impresses me is that folks get their money, and you would think they would just get their money and run. But we get a lot of people, they get their money and they just still want to stay and try to help other people that are stuck in the same situation.
Our hearts broke when we talked with a Native American father about why he was there.
As someone who's lost children to suicide, another son who had difficulties, unresolved grief dealing with his brother's death, any drug he could find, looking at a wall, was how he ended in the loneliness of the spirit. This is no life for anyone. There is help out there.
His son had recently graduated from law school.
That is the state of where we are at. My kids and other kids, they deserve a fighting chance. And this country isn't giving it to them. They're cutting their lives short. In the short of marginalized, in the lives of people who have been marginalized, especially during COVID, we can see it. I'm standing here without my children, man. And when somebody asks me, how can I fix it? My answer is bring them back to me. And there's no power on earth can do it. I don't want another dad, another mom to feel the way I feel.
Ms. Latasha Brown from Black Voters Matter echoed that empathy.
I am here because I believe in us, right? I believe in us more than I believe in the government. I believe if America is to change or to become what it says it is, then we would have to make it be so. I am here because I'm standing in the spirit of my ancestors who were brought here as enslaved Africans, as we're here on the weekend of Juneteenth, and that in this moment that we are asserting our freedom, affirming our humanity, and declaring that we will literally take this land, and this will be a land that is about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all people. I am here because Black voters matter.
And a group of young organizers from West Virginia said they were doing it for those who will follow them too.
The reason why I'm more so involved in it is because I know, you know, times are hard on everybody. And, you know, in particular, things tend to get taken out on like the children of these communities. We got to start with and hold ourselves accountable and make sure that we're doing our part as like adults or up and coming adults. And especially getting out and making sure that everyone's voting and, you know, or knows that they have the opportunity to do so is a big part of getting out and doing our part, because getting these people to come out of their houses and actually vote on the officials that are representing their values to pull themselves out of the situations that they're in is like the key component to actually making changes in our communities. And a lot of them, knowing like friends, family members, they don't really tend to like trust it, but if they see like our faces out here, the young people that they know that relate to it, it kind of pushes them forward to actually start maybe I should get involved. Maybe I should look into it. Oh, there's this program out there.
Melissa, we're trained to measure the success of a movement by the achievement of tangible short-term policy goals. And I say this as both a political scientist and as an organizer. There is no doubt that policy making matters. And I can tell you a simple truism about politics, that policy is about collective choices, and how we make those choices has everything to do with who has power in a democracy. So yes, I was reminded last Saturday that organizing is connected to policy, but it's also something unique. Organizing is about finding the strength and the hope and the direction to remain in the long struggle to make the world better than how we found it.
All right, stick with us. We're going to continue our deep dive into fair housing right after this short break, and we're going to consider who is still not protected by this federal law.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, we had action, and we had action in the various areas where the people were. This is the reason why we were able to win.
You're listening to the voice of A. Philip Randolph, arguably the most consequential labor organizer of the 20th century. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. I'm here with Dorian Warren, and we're taking a deep dive into the movement to end American poverty. Now, the history of this movement is long and complex, but it cannot be told without the singular figure of A. Philip Randolph.
In 1925, he founded the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and Maids, creating political and organizing space at the intersection of racial and economic justice.
But he wasn't done yet. 20 years later, Randolph first imagined the possibility of a mass march on Washington. Now, here's Professor Khalil Gibran Muhammad of Harvard University in a biography series episode about Randolph.
A. Philip Randolph is the broker of the March on Washington movement, which is a threat posed to Franklin Delano Roosevelt to integrate the defense industries. With the threat of 100,000 black people marching on Washington in 1941, Franklin Delano Roosevelt preemptively signs Executive Order 8802, the Fair Employment Practices Commission.
And still Randolph was not done. 20 years after effectively pressuring President Roosevelt and securing a ban on discriminatory practices by federal agencies, unions, and companies doing war-related work, Randolph again visited the Oval Office. The late Congressman John Lewis tells the story.
A small group of us met with President Kennedy, and in that meeting, A. Philip Randolph, this prince of a man, the dean of black leadership, spoke up, and he said in his baritone voice, "Mr. President, the black masses are restless, and we're going to march on Washington."
And indeed, they marched. On August 28, 1963, the March on Washington, the March on Washington, brought more than a 250,000 people to Washington, D.C. for the March for Jobs and Freedom. And this is important. It's critical to remember that even in the moment we identify most closely with the movement for racial justice and civil rights, organizers and participants alike were putting poverty and economic equality on the table for action.
And of course, taking a cue maybe from his mentor and colleague, A. Philip Randolph, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. became ever more explicit about the ties between economic and racial justice in his later organizing. In 1967, at a staff retreat of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, King announced the Poor People's Campaign. And he envisioned it as a campaign to demand jobs, unemployment insurance, a fair minimum wage, and adult education. This was the work he was doing when he was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee, just 5 months later.
And nearly 60 years after the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, nearly 100 years after A. Philip Randolph established the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and Maids, it is that unfinished work that brought so many to downtown Washington, D.C. last Saturday.
My father marched with Martin Luther King 3 times. My grandfather was a Pullman porter. Other great-grandfather was Tuskegee Airman.
This is Justin Blake, the uncle of Jacob Blake, whose shooting sparked protest in Wisconsin. Protest that a young Kyle Rittenhouse, armed with a semi-automatic AR-15-style rifle, attended. There, Rittenhouse fatally shot 2 people.
Our family has been fighting for the rights for our people for over 100 years plus. And it ain't gonna stop. We're here to represent the Blake family, Families United, which is Breonna Taylor's family, the Floyd families and other families, the Black Underground Recycling from Chicago. We wanna see change. We are the change. We're on a precipice of rolling this country over and opening up to what it actually should be. Not what they talked about, but what it should be. And that means African Americans, other minorities, and those who celebrate their sexual orientations in a different way, having the same freedoms that they talk about, that our white counterparts are able to have every day they wake up and shower and go out the door. We must have that same, able to walk the streets and hold our head up in the same flavor.
During last month's Poor People's March, Dorian caught up with Dr. Bernice King, the daughter of Dr. King and Coretta Scott King, and the current CEO of the King Center.
When I am a part of things like this, or see and observe things like this, I know that the work that my father began is continuing, that those seeds are sprouting forth. And although we may not see the major progress that people would like to see, these are great efforts, and they're going to make a difference. I know people don't believe that, but they are making a difference. They are appealing to the conscience of people, and more people are being rallied together to connect to this, because change only comes with a critical mass of people.
Just 5 years old when her father was assassinated, Bernice King is a student of his work, his philosophy, and his public policy demands.
My daddy laid it out in 67 when he said, look, the people who have nothing to lose are those who are impacted by poverty. And so you can't stop us. You can't. You're already doing something to us. So what else can you really do to us? Because we're here. So we're here for the long haul. And the stamina is what's going to be required.
One of the demands of the 1963 March on Washington was a $2 an hour minimum wage. Now, that's $19 in today's inflation-adjusted dollars and $4 more than the benchmark that advocates and the current administration have championed.
So we're behind. It really maybe should be 20. And so they can begin to do something.
As much as Saturday's event revealed the continuing relevance of Dr. King's work, it also laid bare how painfully slow meaningful progress on poverty has been and the ways that progress leaps forward and then falls back.
So that's got me thinking about Marion Wright Edelman. In 1967, Marion Wright was just a young attorney working in Mississippi for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. It was actually she who suggested the Poor People's Campaign to Dr. King, in part because earlier that year, Wright had testified before a Senate committee about President Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty and how it was working or not working in Mississippi. She warned about Black land loss, about hunger, and about racial terrorism against Black folk who were just exercising their political and civil rights.
And of course, Marion Wright Edelman went on to found the Children's Defense Fund in 1973 and led the organization until 2018. CDF has long been at the forefront of the battle against child poverty. And at the march last weekend, I talked with its current leader,
Reverend Dr. Starsky Wilson, blessed to serve as President and CEO of the Children's Defense Fund. I'm here in solidarity with the Poor People's Campaign and this mass people's movement because the poorest group of Americans is those under the age of 18. And so at the Children's Defense Fund, we've been working to end child poverty for two generations. And unfortunately, there's still much more work to do. And so as long as of those 74 million children that are majority Black or brown, one in seven of them lives in poverty. And when we can have a year like last year, where we dramatically reduce child poverty by 40%, and then have a January like this one, where we let it increase again, then we've got to build power for our policy work. And that only happens in solidarity.
The policy that Reverend Dr. Wilson is referencing here, the one that lifted millions of children out of poverty in a single year, that was the temporary expansion of the child tax credit, which was part of the pandemic-era American Rescue Plan. Parents started receiving monthly payments of up to $300 per month for young children, and it was hugely and immediately successful, especially for half of Black and Latino children who were lifted out of poverty in 2021. And then it was allowed to expire. Reverend Liz Theo Harris, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, explained the consequences of that expiration.
What we also saw was that families that now, a couple months after the child tax credit has not been extended, are you know, half of families that were receiving the child tax credit are now saying that they don't have enough food. I mean, this isn't a country that throws out more food than it takes to feed everybody. And yet half of the families who were receiving the child tax credit, including those families that were not falling below the federal poverty line, but above it, but still were receiving that child tax credit, are now food insecure and going hungry. And so it says something about why we need to change our method of understanding who is poor and measuring who is poor, and why we also need to pass, you know, permanent, long-standing programs and policies that actually address the needs and priorities of poor and low-income people.
And this administration today, here and now, declares unconditional war on poverty in America.
President Lyndon Johnson's 1964 Declaration, it's a common starting point for understanding how America has sought to address poverty. And indeed, one of the ambitious goals of the War on Poverty was the elimination of poverty by the country's bicentennial in 1976. We did miss that deadline. You know, we could also tell the story by beginning more than three decades earlier, when President Roosevelt promised a New Deal to Depression-era America.
I pledge myself to a New Deal for the American people.
Both are kind of reasonable points of entry. But when we begin the story of anti-poverty work in the Oval Office, we can easily miss most of the sustained struggle for economic justice.
There's a bus from Orlando coming up, driving, which is not a short trip. And it's the CNAs, it's the nurses, it's the home care workers. It's all the folks that are taking time out of caring for, it's the who are in the grind, working and living paycheck to paycheck. And yet, we are the ones that are coming through to make our values a reality.
My name is Denise Diaz, and I am the co-executive director of Central Florida Jobs with Justice.
Central Florida Jobs with Justice is a diverse coalition of labor unions and community-based organizations led by people of color, women, and LGBTQ folk. And it's an example of the basic truth that people most affected by problems are also the people capable of creating the most effective solutions for those problems.
As laborers, as workers, as a parent, as someone who's working class, like, and growing up in a working class household, like, the ability for my parents to be able to provide, take me to the doctor when I'm sick, right? Have conversations about school field trips and paying for those things. You know, it's all those things and providing the life that they wanted to provide for me, you know, the best that they could. And still at the end of the day have dignity, you know, dignified.
Truly community-based solutions emerge in many, many spaces.
Chelsea Higgs-Wise of Richmond, Virginia, Marijuana Justice. Marijuana Justice Virginia was founded in 2019, and our slogan is Repeal, Repair, and Reparations. And so we really organized to make a gateway of dismantling the drug war by an equitable legalization in Virginia. Just a little story, y'all. They actually voted to not legalize marijuana until 2024. And for us, we said that's too long. We have to stop the harm right now and have this conversation going. So we kept going all the way to the governor, and he amended that bill in 2021 because of our efforts.
In the movement against poverty, it's so important to shift the center. Yes, the movement gathered in D.C. last weekend, but we can't only look to D.C. to understand what's truly happening around the country to create change. I spoke with one activist organizing in Utah.
Hi, my name is Brianna Puga, she, her pronouns. I am an immigrant rights community organizer from Salt Lake City, Utah, from an organization, Comunidades Unidas, translated to Communities United. It was the 10th year anniversary of DACA, and we heard a lot of narratives of yesterday from our DACA recipients regarding, you know, how appreciative and how thankful they are of DACA, but that we need a more permanent solution. DACA, to many folks in my community, and of course around the nation, continue to say that DACA is just a temporary Band-Aid, and we need a permanent solution. So primarily my job is to hear the wants, the needs, the barriers, the struggles from the undocumented community and try to make as much of an uproar in the state capital.
And I caught up with Kate Blackford, who was working all the way on the other end of the country as the public policy director of Maine's People's Alliance.
Right now, we are really excited to be gearing up for creating a state paid family and medical leave program. We are also working on how to make sure that people aren't getting discriminated against in their housing. We are working on expanding healthcare.
Okay, I think we need to pause here. I'm still processing all these people you connected with at an event about ending poverty. I mean, you've got union organizers out of Florida, decriminalization advocates from Virginia, immigration leaders working in Utah, and health and housing advocates in Maine. That is a lot. And I have to say, it does kind of shift my thinking a bit about this movement, because it's pretty clear that for these folks, fighting poverty is taking a lot of different forms on a lot of different fronts.
Yes, Melissa. And we heard over and over again from Reverend Barber and Reverend Theo Harris that today's anti-poverty movement is a fusion movement, meaning that many people from many different walks of life are organizing around the multiple issues that affect their health and well-being. Think reproductive justice or trans rights or healthcare or housing or childcare, or in a time of voter suppression taking hold in states around the country, the fight for democracy. And that fight for democracy, whether the right to peacefully gather and protest at a march in Washington on a lovely Saturday afternoon, or the right to vote in a free and safe election, this is all a part of this anti-poverty fusion movement. And Melissa, in the work I do at Community Change, I get to work with hundreds of grassroots leaders around the country doing the work of democracy all year round, talking to friends and family and neighbors about the issues in their lives, organizing people to take action, whether in meetings with elected officials or attending a protest, or yes, showing up to vote.
Democracy is more than just voting. It's about actually sharing ideas. I think it's the way that we actually build democracy.
I love this video that Community Change put together to really talk about the work that you all are doing. And so I've got a question for you, Dorian. I mean, are people tired? Because this is a lot of work.
One of the people we chatted with was Mrs. Viola Washington from New Orleans.
It's important that we come together to fight racism and all the other isms that controls our lives. And you know, we're just tired. I mean, I'm older than you guys, and I've been doing this for a long time. And I'm just sick and tired, and I don't want it to take that long before the change, and you guys end up being old as me and still tired, you know what I'm saying? So we just want young people to join the march. I joined the march in 1968 with Dr. Martin Luther King, because I lived in Memphis, Tennessee. And I marched with Dr. King, and that was what inspired me to do what I do. And now I'm the director of the Welfare Rights Organization in New Orleans, Louisiana. And it's just been a long fight, but I'm not giving up. We just gotta continue to work until we know that you all are doing it when we're not doing it.
What Mrs. Washington said is really, really stuck with me, because she's been in the movement a long time and she is not giving up. But Melissa, she is tired.
You know, I heard that too, and I was thinking, we've been talking about the Poor People's Campaign. We've been talking about the poor part, the poverty question. But the other piece of it is people. I mean, this is a campaign, ultimately an effort, a movement across decades to make life better for people living in poverty. But it occurs to me, it is the people living in poverty who are also doing this really hard work. And it takes a meaningful toll on people.
It's exhausting work. It's necessary work. And we heard a little bit from former Congressman John Lewis earlier, who always reminded us to make good trouble. These are people who are making good trouble to shift the conversation, to not be silent anymore, and to say that we can actually end poverty in America if we made different choices. But that work takes day in and day out conversations and showing up, and it's exhausting. It's exhausting, but people are not giving up, because all the folks I talked to, Melissa, were so hopeful, and that's why they showed up at the march on Saturday.
Look, I take your point, and I appreciate you returning us to the late Congressman John Lewis. So I'm going to tell a little story here, because I was with the late Congressman Lewis in Selma, Alabama, on the 50th anniversary of the march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And we happened to be standing outside, and I asked him, Congressman Lewis, what do you remember about that day? Clearly a question he's been asked many times. But Dorian, what he said to me was, I remember that it was cold.
Mm.
And I thought about that. I was like, yeah, I've seen that image many times of the brutality against a young John Lewis. And he was wearing that overcoat. You can probably picture it in your mind's eye if you've ever seen that image. Mm. And, you know, this was Alabama, right? It didn't necessarily have to be cold on that spring day. But my goodness, it was such a reminder. John Lewis can seem just like spirit and goodness and voice and intellect, but he was also a body, an actual embodied person, someone who got cold and someone who, when he was beaten, bled. And it was my thinking about the late Congressman Lewis that led me to ask the Bishop William Barber about his own embodied experience of leading the Poor People's Campaign. Bishop, my friend, are you at all tired or discouraged?
You know, I want to be very real with you. Let me be honest with you, Melissa, and your audience. I'm 60 years old, almost. There are days that I get tired of having to fight the things that my mother had to fight. And one day, I actually was talking to her about this. And she said, I bore you 2 days after the March on Washington, August 30 of 1963. It's a few days after you were born, they blew up four girls in a Birmingham church. And I asked the question, what have I done? What kind of world have I brought my child into? My father was a pastor. My mother was an organist. But then her and my father decided that they would commit themselves to transformation. She said, I never thought that my son would have to fight for things that we fought for then. We were fighting to try to make sure you didn't have to. But then she looked at me and she cried that one tear that Black women cry sometimes when they're angry and frustrated, and it comes out of one eye. And she looked at me and said, but you better fight. You better fight. And, you know, whatever tiredness I had, that went away. You know, I battle extreme arthritis. Mm-hmm. But when I go into these communities like the Bronx and Appalachia and down in Arizona with the Apache people that are suffering on federal lands, and in Texas at the border, and hear about and all these places, I see people who are much in situations worse than me. And they're saying, Reverend Barber, we won't be silent anymore. We can't stop. And so that buoys us, that strengthens us, gives us the courage and the fortitude. But then, Melissa, there's one more thing I want to share with your audience, because it might help somebody. I was doing this COVID. One day I got really Howard Thurman. I was really musing, because I was really struggling with why was I still alive. And what I mean by that is I had one family in our church that lost 12 family members across the nation. There's a young lady in our movement. She lost 25 family members in a 30-mile radius in Mississippi, mainly because of the gross inequities in healthcare in Mississippi. And I just asked the question, why am I still alive? I have immune deficiencies. I know that if I had gotten COVID without a vaccination, I could be gone. And a few days later, you know, I'm a part Pentecostal. The Spirit said to me, wrong question. The question is never why are you still alive? Because the day you were born, people died. You faced death, seen and unseen, throughout life. All of people have. All of us live 6 minutes away from death, because if anybody loses breath for 6 minutes, most of the time that's it. The question is, what are you going to do with the breath you have left? Whether it's 6 minutes, 6 hours, 6 weeks, 6 days, 6 months, 6 years, or 60 years. What are you going to do? And I decided with some others that breath is too valuable a commodity to waste it lying, to waste it being hateful, to waste it on injustice, to waste it on being unmerciful. If I've got some breath until I don't have any more, I'm going to join it with other people to create a mighty wind of transformation to breathe some more justice, some more love, some more hope, some more truth into this democracy, into this world, until I take my last breath. And I'm very serious about that.
Dorian, as always, thank you so much for deep diving here on The Takeaway. And special thanks to you for being out there in the field with mic in hand.
Always a pleasure, Melissa. And I think we better give some major love to Takeaway senior producer Shanta Covington and Takeaway digital editor Zach Bynum for being out there in the field with me, because without them, this could not have been possible.
And hey, folks, next week, we are deep diving all week. We're revisiting some of our biggest topics with some very smart people. We're talking death penalty, fair housing, water rights, sex work, and more. It's going to be a big week, and don't miss it. And as always, let us know what you think at 877-869-8253.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Dorian Warren.
And I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. And this is The Takeaway.
Come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.